It's to the best of our knowledge. What if I told you that you owe your existence to a mushroom?
Oh yes, Fungus Man. Fungus Man is very interesting. He's the personification of a large bracket fungus.
Lawrence Millman, with a story from way back in the mists of time.
Fungus Man was a friend of Raven, who created the world. Raven created men, but then scratched his head. What do I do next? There doesn't seem to be any more of the species I've just created. But Fungus Man was quite smart. He told Raven, "I can take you in my canoe to the island where female genitalia scamper around." And they arrive on this island, and there are all these female genitalia scampering over the rocks. The description in the myth makes them look a little bit like chitin shell. So Raven is really happy, and he collects a lot of them and takes them back and affixes them to the men. They therefore become women, and then the men who don't have them affixed to themselves look very happily at the men who do, who are now women. As the old man who told me this story said, "If it wasn't for Fungus Man, I wouldn't be telling you this story and you wouldn't be here to listen to it."
There's a lot of truth buried in myths. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this one is from the Haida First Nation people in British Columbia. And the truth? We do owe our past and maybe future existence on Earth to the kingdom of mushrooms, fungi.
Let's go back in time. Most people may not realize that we shared a common ancestor with fungi 650 million years ago.
Mycologist Paul Stamets.
Fungi were the first organisms to come to land. As they grow, they lead the path, and then plants came to land several hundred million years after fungi. Now we go back to 250 million years ago, and we had a great cataclysmic event. Enormous amounts of debris were jettisoned into the atmosphere. Sunlight was choked off, probably for decades. We don't know how long. A massive extinction. Most plants and animals became extinct, and fungi inherited the Earth. And those organisms that paired with fungi survived. And this is a lesson that we need to learn. We are now in 6X, the sixth greatest extinction event known in the history of life on this planet. We pair with fungi, we will hopefully survive this extinction event.
Can mushrooms save the world? Let's find out. First of all, can I just say, other than when I'm cooking, I don't really think about mushrooms all that much. But then Steve Paulson started talking about Paul Stamets. This has to be the most passionate mycologist on the planet. Paul is an evangelist for the healing power of mushrooms. He spends his time roaming old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest looking for rare species. And he works with the U.S. Defense Department and the NIH to develop new technologies and new medicines from mushrooms. For example,
Well, of course, everyone knows about penicillin that came from a mold, but many of the mushroom-producing fungi are very strongly active against bacteria, including MRSA, staph, including E. coli, and I'm doing research against Mycobacterium tuberculosum. One of our fungi from the old-growth forest, which is called agaricon, shows to be highly active against orthopoxes, including smallpox. And so much of my resources and attention has been focused on getting as many strains of this old-growth fungus in culture as possible because it's rapidly on the decline. And as pollution and the forests are cut back, we're losing what I call mycodiversity. And it's very important that we preserve some of these ancestral strains before they become extinct.
So tell me how this would work. I mean, suppose there was an outbreak of smallpox. How might this particular fungus be used as a remedy?
So what's unique about this fungus, it used to grow in Europe and is now practically extinct. The ancient name is called agaricon, but the Greek name for it was Elixirium ad longum vitam, the elixir of long life. And Dioscorides first published it in 65 AD as a treatment against consumption, a respiratory illness later thought to be tuberculosis. And so we have a sort of a mystery at hand because agaricon is dually active against DNA viruses, which is pox and herpes, and RNA viruses, which is flu A's and flu B's. And that's a conundrum because most virologists would say, well, that's not right. And it may well be that this agaricon mushroom, for instance, it grows 100 feet up in the trees oftentimes. So I have to find them when the trees have fallen down or when they're growing low, or else climb the trees with a friend of mine. But it's subject to 100-mile-an-hour winds, hundreds of inches of rain per year. And yet this mushroom grows for up to 75 years under these adverse conditions, and this mushroom does not rot.
Why is it so hardy?
Oh, good question. I'm asking the same question as well, and I think we can benefit from examples in nature, and that's what we are on the path to discovery, hopefully.
Now, you have been talking about how you love doing your research in old-growth forests, and you live in the state of Washington, and you have brought into the studio a huge fungus. Or is it a mushroom? I guess I'm not exactly sure what the difference is there.
So, yes, this is a mushroom. Now, there's 1 to 2 million species of fungi estimated in the kingdom. 10% are mushroom-forming fungi, about 150,000 species. But we've only identified 14,000 species so far. So more than 90% of the species of mushrooms have not yet been identified. This one is a large wood conch.
It's roughly, what, about a foot and a half long, maybe a foot high, sort of roughly the shape of an oversized football.
Well, it looks to many people like a wasp nest or a beehive.
Right. Yes.
And it has concentric rings of growth, and those are annual growth rings. It's hard like wood. In fact, TSA broke my agaricon.
As you were going through the airport?
I was going through the airport. They wanted to know what was inside of it. I was horrified. It's a fungus. What's inside of it? More fungus, right?
So this is a particularly rare mushroom.
This is one of the rarest mushrooms in the old growth forest. It's exclusive to the old growth forest, now thought to be extinct in Europe. The more that I study this mushroom, the more excited I am. It's really, I think, could go down in history as a medical breakthrough, as a resource for novel antibacterial and antiviral medicines together.
Now, there have also been fungi used to help clean up toxic waste sites, right?
Yeah, that's mycoremediation. That's something I've been actively involved in, running these mycelial mats on wood chips outdoors downstream from factories and farms. And the mycelial networks capture pollutants and they gobble them up.
Now, what do these mats look like?
Everyone can see them today. Just go outside, find a piece of wood, and just tip the piece of wood up. And you'll see underneath this white velvet, fine fibrous network called mycelium. And it's analogous to the roots of an apple tree gives rise to the tree that gives an apple. Well, the roots are the mycelial network that is in all landscapes. And under certain conditions, it produces a fruit, which is called mushrooms. The largest organism in the world is a mycelial mat in eastern Oregon. It's 2,200 acres in size.
Wow.
1,665 football fields.
You're saying this is one single organism?
One single organism, and it's one cell wall thick. When you see it dense on the ground, there can be more than 8 miles of mycelium per cubic inch. This is the foundation of the food web. These are the interface organisms between life and death, and they build soil.
So what kinds of toxic substances then are sucked up by this mycelium?
A whole pantheon of compounds. These are grand molecular disassemblers. We've been able to break down diesel spills, oil spills. Two of our fungi broke down VX, somin and sarin, which is a potent neurotoxin.
So the trick, in a sense, to having a successful cleanup operation at a waste site, particularly a toxic waste site, is to be able to break down those nasty substances. And you're saying fungi have particular properties that can do that.
Indeed. A lot of the hydrocarbon-based contaminants, even pesticides and herbicides, we actually can break them down with fungi. There's a mushroom called turkey tail, Trimedes versicolor, that's circumpolar all over the world, grows on wood, and has an amazing property. It binds mercury. Even when it's dead, you can powder this mycelium up and you can throw it into mercuric ions in water. And the mycelium hyperaccumulates selenium. And the selenium and the mercury come together as a biomolecular unit that makes it totally non-toxic. So the implications are enormous. These fungi offer a platform of solutions on multiple levels. And this is what's so exciting about them. But this is what nature is all about. Nature speaks to us all the time. We just need to listen.
So here you are telling us that mushrooms can, in some ways, help save the world. And yet my guess is that the vast majority of scientists kind of take mushrooms for granted, or they don't really think about it very much. So why are you out there when so few other people are, you know, touting the great benefits of these things?
Well, I'm in great despair that something so important is so under-evaluated, understudied, underfunded, and not given the priority that it should be. I like to say that the mycology departments should be as well-funded as the computer science departments. It is that important for the survival of life on this planet. And it speaks a little bit to what we call mycophobia, the irrational fear of fungi.
Mm-hmm. Well, for one thing, we've heard that some of them are poisonous.
If a person dies from mushroom poisoning in the United States, virtually every news media will pick it up. Very few people do die from mushroom poisoning. Very few mushrooms comparatively are poisonous. Of course, you should know what mushrooms are edible or poisonous before you ingest them, just like any plants. Thankfully, we're a pluralistic society, and we've benefited from Polish people and Europeans and the Japanese and Koreans and the Chinese. They're very mycophilic societies. Hmm. The Chinese look at, for instance, the cordyceps mushroom that comes from insects as rebirth. You know, it's a whole different psychology of looking at nature. And this is, Al Gore and E.O. Wilson and other people have spoke to this, but we are really in a serious trouble. It is far more serious than I think anyone fully realizes. We are in a massive extinction event, and E.O. Wilson predicts that 50% of the known species will become extinct in the next 100 years. What happens when we lose biodiversity and microdiversity? It's like losing rivets of an airplane. At some point, we'll undergo catastrophic failure. You know, we are evolutionary successes today. Yahoo, we made it so far, but for how long? And I've often thought if there was a United Organization of Organisms, otherwise called uh-oh, would we be voted on the planet or off the planet? I think that vote's happening right now. And unless we get our act together and join with nature, we are could perhaps be a victim of the extinction event that we're creating.
That's mycologist Paul Stamets talking with Steve Paulson. Paul is a researcher and writer. He's filed 22 patents for mushroom-related technologies. He also runs a business called Fungi Perfecti. So as you've guessed, we're talking about the wonders of mushrooms today. And I have to say, there is something both charming and also slightly weird about the level of devotion that mushrooms seem to inspire. It's like this really intense fan club or cult. I mean, there are people all over this country who will go to all kinds of extremes for a single mushroom.
Just last fall, here in New York, we had a really great year for maitake, Grifola frondosa, which grow under mature oak. And we were having a fantastic time just looking up the names of cemeteries that had oak in the name. So then we go drive up to the cemetery and collect the mushrooms that are growing under the trees. And so on the way back from one of these cemetery hunts in the fall, I saw this really big maitake growing underneath a tree in somebody's front yard. This is in Long Island. And my husband and I were like, should we just grab it? No, we can't. It's just wrong. So after much like walking back and forth in front of this poor person's house, I finally knocked on the door and he was like, I was wondering what you're doing out there. And we said, is it okay if we take the mushroom? We'll give you half of it. And he said, no, get rid of it. I don't want it, you know.
How big was that mushroom?
Well, probably about 14 pounds.
Wow.
It was a really big mushroom. We could see it from the road. And they can grow to be tremendous. And this one was tremendous.
Meet the mushroom hunters next. I'm Ann Strandchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. How far would you go for a mushroom? And you can't find them at the grocery store, but you could also start picking your own, maybe in secret, wild places you wouldn't tell even your closest friends about. Then you could start hanging out at mushroom festivals where you can drink mushroom beer and sing mushroom songs with other mushroom fans. At that point, you might start organizing your travel around mushroom seasons. Well, Eugenia Bone does all of that. She's a food writer and a self-described mycophiliac. Shannon Henry Kleiber caught up with her the day before yet another mushroom expedition, this one to the Sierra Mountains to hunt for morels after a wildfire, with a very big duffel bag.
So morels, certain kinds of morels, grow in copious amounts after a fire. So the fire happens in the summer, and if there's enough rain in the spring, you know, in certain habitats, these morels come up in huge numbers. And for the last, well, quite a few years, I've been going out to hunt whatever burns I could find. And so the Sierras have been happening, burning, for the last few years. So I fly out, and I use my miles. I go on out there. I rent a car with knobby wheels, and we take off into the Sierras, and I bring home very large amounts of morels. I will probably bring 15 pounds of morels back that are fresh, and then more that are dried. So, yeah, I'll have a duffel full of mushrooms. We pick a lot of mushrooms, and it's super fun. Morels, by the way, I think they're like $200 a pound. That's what you'd pay. So you can do the math.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are they your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
You know, I have a sort of top three or four. I love gypsy mushrooms. I love morels. I love porcini mushrooms, the bilitis mushrooms. I love chanterelles. I love hedgehogs. You know, I like all the wild ones the most, but the cultivated, you know, I'm not going to turn up my nose at a nice plate of sautéed champignon.
Oh, that sounds delicious. So tell me about the taste of some of those favorites. Take me through the taste, because they all taste different from each other.
Well, to a degree, right? Mushrooms are mushrooms, so they're...
They have umami, right?
Yeah, they're all this sort of... yeah, exactly, this kind of meaty savoriness. And that's thought to be the result of... mushrooms contain a kind of pretty high-grade protein. So that meaty savoriness is what... You're tasting that high-grade protein when you eat a mushroom. That's where the umami flavor is thought to come from. One of the main differences, I think, between, say... let's look at maitake, right, which is the Grifola frondosa. It's like this feathery mushroom. It looks like a little hen. You find them under oak trees in the wild, and you can find them in the supermarket, too. They're cultivated. So the wild ones taste... it's like the difference between a domestic duck and a wild duck. The wild... maitake are kind of gamier. You taste more different soil type things, soil and bark and leaves and, you know, worms. And they're more complex in a way, whereas the cultivated maitake, which are grown on a bag of oak chips, they don't have quite the complexity. So that's a distinctive difference. Then, you know, the different tastes between the mushrooms, you know, some are more nutty, like the porcini. Some are more perfumey or fruity, like the chanterelle. The truffles are amazing. They're like pretty much always a combination of certain strong flavors like garlic and B.O. It's always like the B.O. quality. And I think that's what's just so great. People always romance about truffles, saying, oh, it's the, you know, you smell the wet leaves. And I smell like B.O. and it's great.
And you love it.
I do. And they're all like that. Even the truffles, I've gone truffle hunting in Oregon. They have other species. The black truffle is like a cross between like a pineapple and a fart. It's just divine. And then there's another one, a little white one. That's really kind of great. That's like a garlicky armpit. I love that one.
A garlicky armpit. That's a great description. So
yeah.
To the very best kind of have that kind of dichotomy of like something amazing and something kind of awful, and it makes the combination powerful.
That's, you know, that's what makes you love / lust it. You know, it's that it just turns people on. I mean, in the past, boy, one time I remember I was at Soma Camp in California. That's Sonoma Mycological Association. And I picked a whole bunch of candy caps, which are great mushrooms. They have a flavor of maple syrup. And they're so cool because that mapley taste, it gets into your bloodstream or something, but it's like when you pee, it smells like maple. I mean, all of your sweat, everything sort of smells like maple. Your sex smells like maple syrup. It's a very cool mushroom on a lot of levels.
That's great. Those are interesting. Where do you get candy cap mushrooms? Do you have to find those in the wild?
Yeah. You know, there's camps and festivals all over the country, by the way.
So how do you love to cook mushrooms? What are your, I love sautéed in butter and onions and garlic and cheese and eggs. I'm just thinking of all the kinds of things I like to cook with mushrooms. What are your favorite ways to cook?
I cook different mushrooms different ways. So the really exciting thing is, you know, you go out, you forage the mushrooms, you bring home a nice haul, and then what's the first thing you make? That's sort of my litmus test. So if I'm collecting the porcini, which we find in Colorado in the West Elks, and these are wonderful, chubby mushrooms that are, we find them at 12,000 feet, pretty high altitude in under conifer. And the porcini, we slice on a, you know, like a mandolin into really, really thin slices. And then we slice Parmesan cheese from a hunk into really thin slices, and then salt and olive oil. And we eat them raw.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
There's not a whole lot of mushrooms that are ideal to eat raw, but these, like morels, if you eat a morel raw, you'll probably get sick from it because morels have to be cooked. But the porcini is fantastic raw. If I get a big load of morels, like the first thing I'll do when I get home after the red eye, after I collect these mushrooms in the Sierras, then I take the red eye home with all of my mushrooms in my suitcase, I'll do one of my favorite dishes, which is in a Dutch oven. I put in a cut up chicken and a stick of butter and a bottle of dry sherry and as many morels as I feel like I can part with at that meal. And I cook it all together and then finish with a little cream and chopped tarragon and black pepper. And it's very luscious and very, I don't know, French, I guess. It's just divine.
So obviously some mushrooms are dangerous. They could kill us. They could make us very sick. How can you tell the difference? And have you had a close call?
You know, I always have thought it's a good idea to try to learn the ones that are poisonous with as much interest and vigor as the ones that are edible. There's not so many poisonous ones. I mean, there's not so many that are going to take your liver out, right, in 36 hours, but there's a few. And learning to identify them, it's just learning how to identify, you know, you're not going to go into the woods and just eat like some berry on a bush, right? You're going to know which ones are edible and which ones are poisonous. So it's just a kind of learning curve. But then there's like all these mushrooms, you know, it's a spectrum, right? So there's some that kill you, and then there's some that are really delicious, like truffles, and then there's everything in between. So a typical example would be, you know, those mushrooms that we eat that are considered poisonous, but we eat willingly, like intoxicating mushrooms, or mushrooms that some people eat willingly. Or, for example, the Amanita muscaria, the red mushroom with the white dots. So most of the time people think, oh, that's a poisonous mushroom. But my dad told me this story about how there's this fellow, Nick Mastro Pietro. He lived in Yonkers. He had a Christmas tree farm. And Dad was visiting Nick at the Christmas tree farm, and they were walking around, and Nick points to the Amanita muscaria, the red mushroom with the white dots on it that's growing underneath the Christmas trees. And Nick said, oh, that's a good mushroom. And my dad said, are you kidding? That's a poisonous mushroom. And Nick said, no, it's really good. It's just that every time I eat it, right afterwards, I fall right to sleep. And my dad's like, you're lucky you wake up. Well, it is, in fact, edible. I've eaten it before. So I ate it. It was really great. Promptly, right after I ate it, I fell into this coma-like sleep. I mean, it lasted 3.5 hours or something. It was like the drug they give you when you have to have a colonoscopy. I mean, it was completely out. And I woke up with, you know, one shoe on. Well, but it turns out that this is a mushroom in this capacity that's used with one tribe anyway, the Evan tribe in Siberia. And then the mushroom is prepared and used as a sleep aid for elderly people. So when we talk about poisonous mushrooms, you know, it's a spectrum.
Like, so was it a good sleep?
It was a complete and total unconsciousness.
Do you think that in studying mushrooms, there's something we can learn more about ourselves as humans?
For me, I would say, yeah, I think there's a lot, but what is most meaningful to me was the realization that what I thought was the world, you know, was really limited by my perspective. And that when I started to get into mushrooms, I realized that there was a lot more to nature than I could see from where I was standing. And I had to take that extra step to start learning about it. You know, because fungi is interesting. They sort of bridge the unseen and seen world. They are microscopic with macroscopic parts, you know, the mushrooms. In a way, like, fungi are like a gateway drug to microbiology, which is this huge subject of great import to the workings of our planet. And just, damn, it's exciting.
Eugenia Bone is a food and nature writer. She's the author of Mycophilia and Microbia, and she's a former president of the New York Mycological Society. Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with her. So mushrooms have inspired scientists and chefs, and mycologist Lawrence Millman says they have also inspired a few composers.
Vasil Halík was a Czech individual of extreme eccentricity who would go into the forest with a notepad and write down the songs that mushrooms were singing. He composed, I think it was about 1,500 mushroom songs. Now, he was indeed a mycologist, so he could identify different species. And the different species had different songs. And he said that he sometimes could identify the species from a distance by the song he heard it singing. I have not decided whether this is an archetypal example of Eastern European humor or some form of synesthesia, i.e. the music and the eyes somehow combine. He was both a serious musician and a serious mycologist. He composed what's called a mycosymphony, a mushroom symphony, where he takes all the mushrooms in the forest and combines them into work. And it's rather obvious that he's heard Béla Bartók singing too.
So then there's another composer, though, John Cage.
John Cage, yes.
You know that my hobby is hunting wild mushrooms.
The American John Cage, composer is maybe the wrong word. He was a performance artist who liked to amuse people and take them out of their boxes. However, he was also a mycologist. He helped restart the New York Mycological Association. His interest in fungi was primarily in edibles, but he wrote these odd poems and books that are in a sort of Thoreauvian about his appreciation of nature.
I was sure that there was a haiku poem that would have to do with mushrooms.
In one of his works, he talks about this fly agaric, Amanita muscaria. It's not deadly poisonous.
Is it hallucinogenic?
Yes. But it also can result in a trip to the restroom. In fact, numerous trips, because it opens the sieves at both ends, so to speak.
That's unknown brings mushroom and leaf together.
But he said that if you played a Beethoven quartet for this mushroom, it will become edible.
Did he make any music inspired by mushrooms?
Yes. He wrote some songs about collecting mushrooms. He didn't listen to mushrooms and then record their music, but he was inspired by looking at them. Definitely inspired by looking at them.
Lawrence Millman tells a lot more stories about mushrooms in his new book, Fungipedia. Okay. We've given you lots of perfectly good, rational reasons to love mushrooms. Now, let's go down the rabbit hole to full-on mushroom consciousness.
By the way, I have a few more helpful hints. One side will make you grow taller.
One side of what?
And the other side will make you grow shorter.
The other side of what?
A mushroom, of course!
Coming up. I'm Anne Strange-Champ. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. So there are mushrooms, and then there are mushrooms. The magic kind.
For me, this experience was all about nature.
This is Michael Pollan.
I was in my garden in New England, and I had an experience of the plants that I'd never had before. It was a humid August day, and the air was palpable. You know, it was thick. And there were these dragonflies, huge amount of dragonfly traffic. To this day, I don't know how much of it was real and how much of it I imagine. It was the end of the day, and the pollinators were getting their last licks in, and the plants were going, you know, me, 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 come pollinate me. And they were talking to the bees, but they were talking to me too. They're returning my gaze, all these leaves. It was like, oh my God, they really are conscious. Everything was alive. And I know how crazy this sounds. I know that plants aren't really conscious in the sense we mean it. So there, you know, mysteries abide.
Michael Pollan is a journalist who's written extensively about food and plants, and most recently about psychedelics in a book called How to Change Your Mind. His experiences led him to join the ranks of ethnobotanists, neuroscientists, and others who are trying to unlock the secrets of psychedelic mushrooms, not in order to have more or better trips, but because they suspect that mushrooms might help answer some of the big questions, like the origins of our evolution, the development of human consciousness. And there's also this totally bizarre idea, the stoned ape theory. Steve Paulson has the story.
The first thing to know is that magic mushrooms go way back in human history.
Probably millennia. I mean, the first reports we have, this isn't a written culture, but when the conquistadors get to Central America, they find people using mushrooms in their religious ceremonies as a sacrament. And they called it Teonatacatl, which is meant flesh of the gods. And that's, of course, what the Christians called their sacrament too, right? It was
right.
The flesh of God that you're eating in the communion. So this was very threatening to the Catholic Church because here was a sacrament that actually really worked. I mean, you didn't need faith to see God. You met God.
Or as the ethnobotanist Dennis McKenna puts it.
It carries a much bigger kick than the Catholic Eucharist. So Catholicism and Christianity brutally suppressed all of these shamanic practices. They were particularly brutal with the mushrooms.
And they crushed it. They absolutely banned it. They destroyed mushroom stones. They tortured people who practiced it.
Mushroom stones. So they were actually like little statues in the shape of mushrooms?
Little statues, and some of them pretty big, but they are stones carved in the shape of mushrooms. There have been many theories about what they're for. They're found all over Guatemala and southern Mexico.
Some of these miniature mushroom stones in Guatemala, they go back to 3000 BC, which is pretty far back.
And now they turn up in farmers' fields occasionally because people buried them. They were afraid to be caught with them. So the mushroom cults, as they were called, and of course we call a religion a cult when we don't like it, went underground and was thought to have disappeared until the middle of the 20th century.
So mushrooms largely disappeared from public view and psychedelics had gone underground. But then the Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann accidentally stumbled onto LSD, and rumors started swirling around that the mushroom was still used in sacred ceremonies in Mexico. And that's when magic mushrooms came roaring back. Thanks to one man, Gordon Wasson.
That's right.
Who would seem to be the most unlikely person to turn psychedelic mushrooms into a mainstream phenomenon. I mean, he was a vice president.
He was a banker. Yeah.
At J.P. Morgan.
He was very plugged in New York. He marries a Russian woman, a pediatrician, and she, like many Russians, is a passionate mycophile. He, like many Americans and people of English extraction, was a mycophobe, fearful of mushrooms. Anyway, the story goes that on their honeymoon, they went up to the Catskills, and they're walking in the woods, and she starts finding all these mushrooms, and she starts collecting them in her skirt and makes this big pile of mushrooms, and she proposes to cook them for dinner. He absolutely refuses to eat them. She eats them. He thinks he's going to wake up a widower the next morning, but lo and behold, she knew what she was doing, and this got him very interested in mushrooms.
So in his spare time, Wasson developed a lifelong obsession with mushrooms. especially the psychedelic ones. He studied how they influenced human cultures around the world and came up with a theory that the origin of religion was actually rooted in people's transcendent experiences on magic mushrooms.
And if you think about it, where do these interesting, bizarre ideas at the heart of many religions come from? That there is a beyond, that there's an unseen world, that there is a realm of the dead that you could visit, that there is a heaven and hell. I mean, these are interesting ideas, and you could see why having a psychedelic journey would convince you of their truth. He looked into the use of Amanita muscaria in Siberia, I think it is, and the Eleusinian mysteries of the ancient Greeks, where they all got together once a year and they had a rite around Demeter, worship of Demeter. And everybody partook of this potion called the Kikion, which has also never been really identified, gave people access to an unseen world. And they went and visited their ancestors. And he believed that, too, might have been a derivative of the ergot fungus. That is the fungus from which LSD is derived. But then the last case, and the most relevant, he heard about these mushroom cults in Central America, and he went looking in Mexico.
For years, didn't he? Multiple trips down there.
I think he had like 11 trips down there.
Looking for someone who would take him in so he could participate in a mushroom ceremony.
Yeah, and given the secrecy that surrounded it, earning someone's trust so they would actually say, yes, we do use mushrooms this way, and yes, I will administer some to you. But he finds a woman, a curandera or a healer named Maria Sabina in the town of Huautla de Jimenez, which is a couple days by mule outside of Oaxaca in the very remote mountains. And she gives him the mushrooms, what she calls the little children. And he has this experience in the basement of this house. And he brings a photographer and he recounts this experience in the pages of Life magazine in a like 17-page article. The reason he gets it into Life magazine is that he's friendly with Henry Luce,
the publisher.
And Henry Luce, as it turns out, is a giant fan of psychedelics. He's had psychedelic therapy. I know, it's the weirdest history.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
But you have to remember, all this is legal, right? This is 1955. He has his experience. In 56 or 57, he publishes the article. And this article really introduces much of the West to psychedelic mushrooms and psychedelic experience in general. So Gordon Wasson is really a pivotal figure in this history.
By the 60s, psychedelics had become part of the counterculture. Not only was there plenty of experimentation, scientists launched a series of innovative research projects on possible therapeutic uses.
So I went to Mexico.
Timothy Leary.
He used mushrooms. They're called sacred mushrooms.
Read Gordon Wasson's story in Life magazine, and once he became a Harvard professor, he ran various studies of both psilocybin and LSD, often involving his own students, which got him kicked out of Harvard. Take a ride to the land inside of your mind. And by the late 60s, the psychedelic revolution had imploded and the FDA shut down all the research. Now, this wasn't exactly like the Spanish crackdown on mushroom cults, but once again,
turned up.
The sacred mushroom went underground. And it might have stayed that way if not for a few mushroom obsessives who kept stoking the flame.
It is still absolutely mysterious, appalling, challenging, boundary-dissolving, and unavoidably ecstatic. It is the living mystery.
Terence McKenna, an ethnobotanist and legendary psychonaut, had traveled all over the world, studying and experimenting with a whole range of hallucinogens. Even after they were banned, McKenna was one of the few people who still talked openly about mushrooms. And he came up with a wild idea that eating magic mushrooms led directly to the origins of human consciousness. Essentially, the mushroom made us human. This is known as the stoned ape theory.
If we're looking for a missing link, it isn't a transitional skeleton. It isn't meddling by extraterrestrials. It has to do with the fact that we began to allow into our diet an exotic pseudo-neurotransmitter. And I believe that mushroom was the triggering factor that moved us from being an advanced hominid, an advanced animal, to being, in fact, a conscious, self-reflecting, caring, thinking, dreaming, striving human being.
Is this true? I find it completely implausible.
Okay, this is really far out. The idea that magic mushrooms rewired the brains of our ancient ancestors and created human consciousness. But the funny thing is, people can't stop talking about it. Now, Terence McKenna died nearly 20 years ago, but his younger brother Dennis, who traveled with Terence on some of their wild psychedelic adventures in South America and wrote two books with him, he has his own take on the stoned ape theory.
Actually, I came up with the idea. If you really want to know, okay. I came up with the idea, but he popularized it. His idea was psilocybin mushrooms enhance visual acuity. They were useful for hunting. You take mushrooms and you could spot the game. Yes, they do that. This is where his theory and my theory differ. I say one of the things that can happen often with psychedelics, and especially with mushrooms, is so-called synesthesia, where you get crosstalk between sensory modalities, so you can see sounds. What I've said for a long time is that this is the key to language, because language is synesthesia. It's a learned skill that mushrooms taught us. I can say a word, table. Chances are you visualize a table in your head, right?
Right.
Mushrooms provided that key link between a meaningless sound, a potentially meaningless image, and a meaningful interpretation. So mushrooms were the key to how we learn to create symbols.
I have to back up for a moment just to see if I understand what you're saying. So you're saying that this ancient consumption of mushrooms, magic mushrooms, tens of thousands of years ago, triggered something in the brains of our human ancestors that helped us be able to talk?
That helped us be able to talk, yes, and actually helped us be able to develop a language. But it's not simply that we ate mushrooms and became smart. We do know from the fossil record that there was an enormous, almost explosive expansion of the hominid brain over about 2 million years. It increased 3 times in size. 2 million years is not very long in evolutionary terms. Something made this happen. These people evolved in complex environments and with a lot of challenges. I think the mushrooms gave them the ability to visualize abstractions, essentially, to create models in their heads. They gave them imagination.
So today, once again, psychedelics are back. Not legally, at least yet. But in labs around the world, scientists are rediscovering their therapeutic uses. We are in a new golden age of psychedelic research, and Robin Carhart-Harris is one of the leading experts. In his lab at London's Imperial College, he's been putting people on psilocybin into brain scanners in his groundbreaking studies of treatments for depression and anxiety. So what does he think of the stoned ape theory?
It's a fascinating idea, really exciting, kind of, you know, spine-chilling. Yet, I'm not sold. I just think that it's a bit too psychedelic-centric. And it's not clear that every human culture took psilocybe mushrooms.
So it could be we're asking the wrong question. Maybe this isn't really a matter of trying to prove that magic mushrooms jump-started the human brain long ago. Carhart-Harris is more interested in figuring out why psychedelics have such powerful effects on the mind and what that might tell us about the nature of human consciousness. He says these substances can open up new neural pathways, and they actually give our brains access to more information. In fact, he calls psychedelics mind-revealing rather than mind-altering.
People have insights, emotional insights, personal insights, remember things, sometimes very remote, into their childhood.
Is this tapping into our unconscious?
Well, that's the implication, yes.
It suggests something pretty powerful, which is that we don't normally, in our everyday waking state, really don't have access to maybe what's most important in our minds. Maybe we need some help getting there.
Yes. And then it raises curious questions like, why has the mind and the brain evolved that way?
And the world is bigger, is what you're saying, on psychedelics, more expansive?
Yeah, I suppose, because so much of world is actually inner, and it's so vast. That's the huge revelation, I think, that psychedelics bring, is just that symbolism and the iconography that you'll see in art, for example, or that's depicted in horror films or in religions, it's all there, you know, in a very vivid and elaborate way that one can experience under a psychedelic.
There's no question a psychedelic experience can blow your mind. It can also be terrifying. And the thing about psychedelics that's different from any other drug, every person's experience is unique and unpredictable, and for most people, unforgettable. Remember Michael Pollan from earlier? He says his psychedelic experiences fundamentally changed him.
The brain is more mysterious, or my brain is more mysterious than I understood, and my mind is. But I also was changed in my understanding of what it means to have a spiritual experience. Something I don't think I'd ever had, something I was kind of allergic to. I tended to think that to be spiritual was to believe in the supernatural, and I very much didn't. I'm really a pretty staunch materialist in my outlook on things. But I found that what happened when my ego dissolved in that psilocybin experience, the walls come down and you merge with whatever is around you. And it made me understand that, no, the real definition of spiritual is not something supernatural, it's connection. Spiritual experience is deep, powerful, undefended connection between the self and what is normally an other, an object. Whether it's another person, music, the universe, nature, the walls come down and you have this powerful sense of connection, which many people call love.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer, Steve Paulson, brought us today's Mushroom episode. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director, and they had help from Mark Rickers, Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Charles Monroe Kane. I'm Anne Strange Champs. Thanks for listening.